Well, good day, and welcome back to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's great to have everybody here with us this week. We've got a great show coming up for you. I know I say it every week, but I'm really excited about the topic tonight. We're going to be revisiting some things about wilderness medicine and how it relates or doesn't to disaster medicine. We'll talk about that a little bit later on. But before we get into that, let's start introducing the rest of the folks here with us tonight. And of course, that always starts with my amazing co-host, Sam Bradley.
Oh, and I so love being amazing. Hi, all. Thanks for coming back. We are going to have a great load of fun tonight. I'm really looking forward to this interview. We're pretty windy out here in Northern California, and we got Dr. Joe and Jim out there in Memphis. So what's it like out there today, Jim?
Well, we're actually so it's not windy here. We're growing gills, so it's our humid time of year. So we're all turning into fish again.
Hi, Dr. Joe.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Great. Doing great. And we have another guest with us. I'm really excited. Dr. Seth Hawkins with us tonight. I interviewed Seth for the first time. Goodness, Seth, it's probably been, 4 or 5 years ago? You were an EMS 10 awardee and were awarded an innovation award for putting together, if I remember, it was a wilderness emergency medical director course.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Ooh, that's awesome.
So,
hey, that's amazing. So what you're saying is we have two EMS Jim's 10 winners on the show tonight. That's amazing.
Yep, absolutely.
And we love them. They're great fodder for podcasts.
Well, and we've talked again and again on the show about why it's important for emergency responders and especially disaster responders, and I think we'll find as well wilderness responders, to be innovators and to be innovative. And I think we're going to find out even more about that in tonight's show. So, Seth, thanks for coming on.
Oh, I appreciate it. It's going to be fun.
So one of the things I wanted to talk about before we get into everything that Seth has to talk about is our news item for the week. And just saw an item in USA Today on the report that has come out recently on the storm surge associated with a major hurricane touching down in some part of the Atlantic or Gulf Coasts. And basically says that along those coastlines, there are $1.5 trillion worth of homes that are at risk for major damage from a hurricane. And we haven't had anything big hit since Hurricane Sandy a few years back, but it is important to recognize that people continue to go back and build and rebuild in these areas and expect that they'll get another 20 years or something out of it when another event could come along the very next year. Any thoughts about that, Sam?
Well, I was just thinking, I worked Hurricane Sandy. I got sent back there because of my expertise in their EPCR program. And I got to see, they were kind of in the cleanup phase, but looking at what, I mean, people were throwing out virtually all of their furniture. I mean, I really felt for everybody. And all of the damage that they suffered, and that was just their stuff. You could also see all the damage to the homes. It would be hard for me to conceive of wanting to start over right there, knowing that it could happen again. I guess that's just the way I think. But yeah, that's a lot of homes and a lot of money.
Joe, do you think that people just have a short-term memory, because thinking about it would just drive people nuts? Because we talk about it all the time, there are inherent disaster issues in every part of the country. I mean, Sam, living in the middle of Earthquake Central, you guys in Memphis are on a fault line and have tornado risk. So what do we think? How do people get through this? Is this just putting their head in the sand?
No, I don't think so. I think that obviously those events are fairly infrequent and all up to chance. And, you know, if you've got a chance to have $1 million home on the on the upper coast of the East Coast, then that's pretty doggone nice. And I expect it's just a risk benefit analysis that doesn't tend to go very well on the risk side. You decide to go ahead and be there and enjoy it. And Yeah, if you get a hurricane, you're just going to get a hurricane. That's what insurance is for.
Guess you got to live somewhere, huh?
There you go.
Well, I'll have a link to this in the show notes, and you know, I encourage people to take a look at it and think about it with regard to your area. We always talk about preparedness and understanding what could affect your community, and whether you're a responder or you're listening to this as a layperson, preparedness starts with thinking about these kinds of things in regard to where you live and where you set up. So I'll have a link in the show notes for this episode, and I urge you to check it out.
I'd like to know what Seth thinks about that question.
Ha!
Ha!
Well, I have to say, you know, one of the exciting or conserved themes between disaster medicine and wilderness medicine is something we call the Gesto principle. So Jamie had mentioned the Wilderness EMS Medical Director course, where we try to train medical providers to serve in medical director roles that they may be unfamiliar with, either people who are awesome EMS physicians but are not familiar with wilderness environments, or people who are great wilderness enthusiasts like skiers or backcountry hikers, but may not have a big experience with EMS. So we bring people together and try to give them the skill sets they need to be medical directors for these environments. And in the course of writing the curriculum for this, we came up with the Gesto principle, which is based off the Disney movie Ratatouille, if anybody's familiar with that. And the lead cook in that, Gesto, teaches that anyone can cook. And our message in a wilderness setting is that anywhere can be a wilderness environment, and everybody has to prepare for it. And I think that's even more true for disaster medicine, and even more appreciable for people. I think that people can understand that even more, that any setting can be a disaster setting in a day, or with one storm or one terrorist event. And in fact, I think that's where they kind of come together, is that most of the environments that become wilderness settings in a day is due to a disaster. So certainly the folks in Miami and the settings that are at high risk for floods and that sort of thing are very familiar with that principle. And I think one of our big messages in the Gesto principle is trying to say you should not be reassured at the fact that you're not living in Miami, or you do not have a what is the movie now? The San Andreas Fault, that you don't live on the San Andreas Fault?
Like, funny you should mention that.
We actually did a review. Joe and I went to see it specifically to do an episode about it, and we actually reviewed it on the show. That episode will be coming out this Thursday. So
look at that. What a hook.
Nice.
I love it. So, well, it's interesting, Seth, because, you know, we talk a lot about training responders, which, of course, you know, Jim and Joe do, but we really don't think about training the people that run those events so much. And I think all of us, based on our personal experience, may have, I guess if you can call it, incomplete skill sets, where we may be strong in some areas but not in all of them. I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, it's been pretty well received, and I think it really addresses a hole in our planning, and maybe there's a hole in the disaster community as well in this regard. I think not quite so much, because I think we've been talking about disaster response as a responsibility of healthcare providers for a long time, and we've thought about how we formalize that. I think for the wilderness setting, so that's something I would maybe express as something that we on the wilderness side could learn well from the disaster side, is that we advocate hard for the idea that all wilderness EMS response teams, and by that I mean even like search and rescue teams and teams that practice BLS care or even first aid care, really benefit from medical direction. And I think the hole that appears is suddenly, you know, it's a little bit of Emperor's New Clothes kind of things, where we realize that the skill, that the talent may actually not be out there right now for every team in the country to have somebody well trained in both EMS and wilderness settings to provide that service. And I think that's a strength of our disaster response infrastructure, is that we've got multiple layers of responder credentials, and it's not as unusual to see physicians both deployed with teams and also in leadership. Although I'd love to know if you guys have experienced that differently. I think you'd find the number of physicians that are responding on the average wilderness rescue or wilderness EMS operation, it is astonishingly small.
Joe, I'd like to toss that one to you. Being a USAR guy, I'm sure you've been involved with wilderness medicine as well. What do you think about that? Are there not enough docs out there taking part in these kinds of things?
Oh, I think Seth is absolutely correct. You know, I can probably name on one hand the number of physicians that I'm aware of that have made any sort of wilderness response, and probably on two hands, or maybe three, the number of docs that are heavily involved in the, you know, disaster side of things as well. And it's interesting. I thought Seth did a great job talking about the how disaster medicine and wilderness medicine are alike. You know, they're both austere environments. And as Seth so eloquently said, you know, for wilderness medicine is a planned austere environment, and disaster medicine is an unplanned austere environment in an area that might not have been an austere environment before. But you know, that similarity can, certainly bridges the gap between the two. I think there's a lot of similar skill sets, and I think there's an awful lot of, need for physicians that have, education and involvement, on both sides of that fence, not only from the disaster side, but also from the wilderness side. There's an awful lot of common ground here.
And Seth, some of the stuff I was reading that you sent us, I was intrigued with the idea of comparing a multiple casualty incident, looking at it from both perspectives, where a DMAT or a USAR may be dealing with a number of patients, you know, and I kind of equate this to the field, being a medic for 1,000 years, even having 5 or 10 patients, if they're critical, that's huge. That's a lot of effort. You need a lot of personnel to manage those. So looking at that from the perspective of the wilderness setting, if you were out there, and I think this has a lot to do with your surroundings and the situation you're in, you could be, at least, you know, if you're with a DMAT or another team, you're going to have resources available you can access quickly. Not so much if you're out there in the middle of nowhere. So that's what makes a real big difference in how you're going to handle something. Am I right about that?
Yeah, I think so. And it's a very interesting, somewhat semantic, somewhat very important operational distinction. You know, we'll have we'll use the word disaster in multiple ways. I use it like frequently in my emergency department in a rural area in North Carolina, like, oh man, this is a disaster tonight, in a very friendly and jovial way. But in the sense of like something becoming a disaster in the wilderness, I in some of the publications we've done recently, I was citing incidents like lightning strikes in national parks, where you may have more than a dozen patients, and avalanches, where there may be searches and multiple patients. And you know, it's a very interesting question what the line is behind or between Nepal and you know, a truly population-based disaster that would mobilize international resources and be managed for months or even years. Where you may have a couple patients, but it's really considered a disaster in that setting. I really think for me, the operational difference, and I'd love to know what others on the podcast feel, is the concept of exceeding local resources. So in many of the cases that I have described of avalanches or of lightning strikes, those incidents that have been managed in the United States have for the most part been managed by local resources and mutual aid agreements, and they can be managed. They don't exceed the ability of the communities that are supposed to manage those operations, although they certainly challenge it and stretch it. So I always think of that as sort of the dividing line, that once you move beyond the capacity for any local agency or even a combination of local agencies to manage adequately, it's now moved into a disaster setting. But the really fascinating thing I think about that in the evolution in our country in the last 15 years in disaster preparation is that we're now even expected to manage those adequately. So the fact that something has exceeded the ability of local resources or even regional resources, you know, post 9/11, post Katrina, the public expectation now is that, you know, throwing up your hands and saying, well, it's a disaster by definition, it exceeds management abilities, is no longer adequate. And we're even tasked with adequately managing those. But that's what I see as the big difference between like a multiple patient or multi-casualty incident in a wilderness setting and something that's truly like a defined disaster.
You know, we talked about that a little bit when we were talking with Sean Maxwell about the Washington State mudslide incident and how they managed that and how it overwhelmed local resources very quickly, and how but the people who lived in that community who were looking for their loved ones weren't accepting the disaster as an excuse. They wanted their loved ones found, recovered, or rescued now. And the expectation was that that's what that would happen. And I think that, you know, we were talking with Sean about that just a few weeks ago here on the show. And Seth, I think you make a very excellent point. Jim, what are your thoughts? I mean, you plan disaster response and preparedness for a major, you know, urban center in Tennessee. And, you know, what are your thoughts about what the expectations of the public are versus what the response capabilities are of the department?
So we certainly live in an age of convenience, right? So we can go anywhere, anytime, get money, get concert tickets, online, ATM, the whole thing. So, and that's why people can expect those things to be done, you know, at a moment's notice. And as we all know, that the challenge is to get that message to the public that that's not realistic. In disasters like we're talking about. So when you look at a Katrina or a 9/11 or, you know, even a mudslide like out in Washington State, we're challenged with those issues of local resources being taxed to their ultimate. And that's the only reason that any DMAT team or any USAR team is ever called in. It was a great segue into what I was thinking. So it's not really about, it's not just about the response capabilities to, you know, meeting the needs of the patients that have been affected, but it's also about taking care of our own. And I always focus on that first, because if USAR focus is when we go out on the road with the deployment, our major focus medically is to take care of those that are within our organization, and secondly, our canine, and thirdly, our patients. So it's a different perspective than DMAT, if you will. So this wilderness medicine. Absolutely, every deployment we go to is wilderness medicine. Everyone. So that is very interesting. We have to adapt to the environment, and it's a challenge logistically, medically, and physically. And so, hats off to you, sir, that do this for fun, but you enjoy doing so. It's kind of one of those things that we don't think about really in the USAR community, that we're going into a wilderness environment, but we really are every time we go out, because the local resources are challenged. They need us. The local resources, as far as logistics, with simple things like showers, like food, like lodging, are all. They're it's all over the board. You know, sometimes we may luck up and find a hotel that's intact, but other times we may be sleeping on a parking lot on asphalt for 5 days. So it's a wilderness experience. We have to adapt. But luckily we have made concessions for those things at some times, but it's not comfortable at all.
Well, on a related note, and Jamie, when you brought up the mudslide, that kind of made me think about it, because some of this is about logistics and routine and what we're used to. You know, you think about a DMAT that we go in when resources are already set up for us. We have a tent to work in. We have the equipment we brought with us and all of those kinds of things. But then you get something like a mudslide, and nobody knows what the hell to do. It's like, this isn't something anybody's ever seen before. Let's call them the mud experts. Well, who are they? So, in essence, I can see how this kind of translates to things you would have in the wilderness environment that aren't routine. You know, what do you do about that when something really different happens? What do you think, Joe?
Oh, I think that's definitely part of it. You know, it's all part of a continuum, I think, with a lot of crossover. There's obviously a very unique skill set to wilderness medicine in the sort of on the prevention and preparation side that's a little bit different from disaster medicine, which tends to be sort of more reactive, I think, because obviously disasters are unplanned events. And the wilderness environment, in many cases, is at least a plannable event for preparation and knowing that you're going to be in an austere environment, so you're ready for it.
And you're going to laugh when I say this, but never forget your Foley catheter, right, Joe?
I was just thinking I was going to go revisit that episode with Seth and see what kind of stuff he carries in his wilderness medicine.
Yeah, we should set Seth up for this one. Joe made a comment that one of the most important things he would carry with him in an austere environment would be to make sure he always had a Foley catheter with him. And Joe, I'll let you explain that.
Well, it's obvious, isn't it? No, I'm just kidding. But it was all kinds of stuff from, you know, it serves as a great tourniquet to, it serves as a way to, do hemorrhage control, and it could be a chest tube if you needed it to be, it could be all kinds of things. And it was one of those tools that can be adopted in an awful lot of different ways to work for how you want it. So, I don't know. I'd be curious to know if you have an interesting and unusual wilderness medicine toolkit.
Oh, I love it. No, so for those of us that grew up in the ER era of the television show, it's the Alan Alda episode where he puts the Foley catheter in as a chest tube. And he's like, yeah, we do that all the time in Vietnam.
Right. Oh, you're on it.
I love that idea of and I think that one of the things you're speaking of is the Swiss Army knife kind of idea that in wilderness medicine in particular, because you're so weight based, you want to make sure that tools that you're bringing in have multiple applications. And I'd love to pitch to you guys a tool set opportunity that's something that my friends at Landmark Learning have been promoting. And I really like this idea, and I really think it meets that Foley catheter toolkit multiple application test. And that's the first responders that we have in our communities from an EMS standpoint. And I know that sounds like a stretch, but I truly feel like this is the biggest, missing toolkit part that we have in our disaster responder armamentaria that happened locally and that people can use wilderness EMS tools that they've already built there for disaster settings. And we'd been mentioning earlier how, wilderness medicine guys do this for fun, like almost like it's a joke, but it's true. And I don't think, I don't think we need to apologize for that, because the fact is that one of the amazing things to me about this country is that every community has these hordes of first responders who get up at 2 a.m. and they go out and help professional providers deliver medical care. And I always say it's kind of like if a cardiologist just loved his job so much that on his days off, he'd go to the hospital and do catheterizations. It just amazes me that our EMS infrastructure is such that even now, with all the strains on volunteerism and on regulations and increased educational and regulatory obligations for volunteers, they still do it. And we have a huge number of these people, and they're an integral part of our EMS system. And so one thing that's really interesting and exciting is the idea of leveraging those kind of human walking toolkits to be applicable in a disaster setting. So, and I have a bias here, I have to say, from a conflict of interest standpoint, that I'm the medical director for Landmark Learning, which is a wilderness medicine school in North Carolina. But I really only became a medical director after they'd already started all these activities, mostly because I thought they were so cool. So I wanted to kind of be a part of it. What they did, this is Justin Padgett, who runs the school here, in 2003, is they started sending medics to Ecuador to train in the Andes and the Amazonian areas for disaster skills. And what they kind of realized was they couldn't get real, ethically, they couldn't get like real life primary care skill sets that they wanted to develop in these responders working in the States. So they went to areas that didn't have a really big public health or primary care infrastructure and pretended they were disasters and pretended people were coming to them with what we all know happens frequently in disasters, which is primary care management, which is really kind of a brilliant idea. And then in 2010, he tried to bring it back to the States because he'd seen a couple disasters here and realized that in some ways he was building a skill set that would be great internationally that we actually, from a regulatory standpoint, couldn't actually bring to bear locally because first responders would not be regulated to the extent that their scopes of practice would permit this activity. So he's been pitching to a couple state EMS organizations the idea of operationally specific skill sets for first responders in disaster settings, where they would actually automatic. So we all kind of talk about how in disasters, sometimes your scope of practice changes somewhat level that you practice. And his concept, which I think is pretty brilliant, is that the guys who are responding to the wilderness calls and the guys who are implementing those operationally specific protocols in a wilderness setting, which often include things like sometimes joint dislocation reductions and other sort of expanded scope kind of things. Spinal mobilization was one of the first things that ever was developed in wilderness EMS, which of course predated the traditional side by 20 or 30 years. Now we all think that reducing spinal, you know, mobility is actually appropriate in the front country. So his concept was these people are already embedded in these communities. It's going to take hours to days for any kind of formal responders to arrive. The fact is the ability to deliver like in situ care there and tell somebody that you know is a very anxious person who's whose chest pain is not going to be cardiac or who just needs a refill of their diabetic medications. These are their neighbors, and to upgrade their skill sets to be operationally specific for those times when you probably won't get an ALS response ever or potentially for hours, but they can go to the neighbors in their community and deliver healthcare. This is a long-winded way to say we have incredible assets in our responders in rural areas who you'd be amazed at what they do from a wilderness standpoint. They're often caring for patients for 6 or 8 or 10 hours. And so to activate them to provide some of the skills that they would be able to do from a regulatory standpoint during a disaster, I think could be a game changer in the first 6, 12, 24 hours of a disaster, or even when formal teams come in, but there's ravines or areas that are hard kind of to get to, and people are really caring for themselves for days. And that's, you know, like we all know, that's the sad experience we saw in Katrina, was that so much care had to be delivered in sight for longer than we expected.
And that's going to wrap up this special episode segment, part one of a two-part episode we are doing with Dr. Seth Hawkins. Dr. Seth is coming to us to talk about wilderness medicine and how it relates to disaster medicine, and we're happy to have him on the show, and we'll pick up with part two of that episode next week here on the show. In the meantime, I want to thank Paragon Medical Education Group for everything they do to sponsor and support this episode and all of our episodes here at disasterpodcast.com. So make sure you head over and thank them for their continued support by visiting them online at paragonmedicalgroup.com or over at Twitter, and follow them and check it back in with them there with all the things they do by visiting them and following them at paragonmededu on Twitter and Paragon Medical Education Group on Facebook. Anyway, we want to thank them for doing that. They really provide great resources for training and education for preparing organizations and jurisdictions for disaster response in their communities. And if you're looking for a new way of training, an experiential way of training with people who've been to disaster scenes and know what they're talking about, you can't go wrong. So check out Paragon Medical Education Group and all the resources they provide. That's it for me, Jamie Davis, the PodMedic, here, your host on Disaster Podcast and DisasterPodcast.com. Make sure you head over and check out all of the episodes, and of course, leave comments and let us know what you want to check out more of in future episodes. I look forward to hearing from you. On behalf of Sam Bradley, Dr. Joe Holly, Jim Logan, and Seth Hawkins, we'll be back next week with part two of this episode. In the meantime, I want to remind you all that, as we've learned in this and most of our episodes here on the show, disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.